Picture this. You've just spent the last few weeks building this incredible AI agent using the Claude Agent SDK.
Oh, yeah, and it feels like absolute magic when it runs perfectly on your laptop.
It really does. It reads your files, it summarizes data, but, well, the moment you take that local AI toy and deploy it into the real world,
That is when things can get incredibly risky.
exactly. You are suddenly at risk of silently burning through thousands of dollars over a single weekend. So, welcome to another deep dive.
Our mission today is figuring out how to take that local agent and transform it into a robust, deployable production service.
Right. We're pulling our insights from Chapter 5 of the Koenig AI Academy's guide on deploying the Claude Agent SDK. We are looking at observability, cost controls, and the security guardrails you need to survive production.
Because the transition from local to production is, it's a massive leap.
Okay, let's unpack this. When most developers think about the biggest risk of deploying an AI agent, their minds immediately go to hallucination, right?
Yeah, they think the worst case scenario is the AI just making up fake data and putting it in a report.
But the data from the Koenig AI Academy materials tells a completely different story.
It really does. The most common production failure mode isn't model hallucination at all. It's cost runaway.
So not the AI writing a bad poem, but the AI quietly draining the entire server budget.
Exactly. Imagine an agent that encounters an unexpected error while trying to parse, like, a massive log file.
Okay.
Instead of stopping, it gets confused. It silently loops on that exact same subtask, retrying and failing for 40 minutes straight.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And because it's an automated process running in the background, there's no human sitting there to monitor the console output.
So by the time you check your dashboard on Monday morning, you are looking at a massive API bill generated over the weekend by just one single runaway agent.
It happens more often than you'd think.
That is terrifying. So if runaway costs and these, unwanted looping actions are the main threats, we have to establish what the agent is actually allowed to do before we even let it run.
Right. Before looking at dynamic controls, you must establish the static rules of engagement. You really have to lock down the baseline permissions.
Which, I mean, sounds easy in theory, but when you are pushing code through a CI/CD pipeline.
Where the whole point is that everything is automated.
Exactly, you don't want human bottlenecks. I can totally see developers getting frustrated if an agent pauses the deployment pipeline to ask for manual permission every single time it wants to edit a
Or
file.
run a bash command, yeah.
Right. So is that why the SDK has that bypass permissions setting? Like, could we just flip that switch to make the automation run smoothly?
I mean, you could, but it is incredibly dangerous. What's fascinating here is that bypass permissions doesn't just silence a few annoying pop-up confirmations.
It does more than that.
Oh, yeah. It disables absolutely all safety checks across the board. It bypasses the model context protocol checks. It bypasses file edit confirmations.
Okay.
And most alarmingly, it bypasses protections on destructive bash command prompts. You're basically handing an autonomous system root access to your environment with zero oversight.
It feels like disabling the firewall on your company's main server just because you are tired of configuring the ports for a new application.
Yeah, it is a much better way to think about it. You get your application running faster, but the entire network is suddenly exposed.
The friction exists for a reason, then.
Exactly.
Okay.
So to get your automation running without requiring a human to click yes 100 times while keeping the blast radius small, you need a two-part configuration.
Okay, so what does that safe alternative actually look like in the code?
First, you use a setting called permission mode, accept edits. This specifically pre-approves file editing, which is, the most common action developers are trying to automate in a pipeline anyway.
Makes sense.
Second, you combine that with a strict, explicit list of tools under the allowed tool setting. If your agent needs to read files, edit files, and run basic scripts, you grant read, edit, and bash, and absolutely nothing else.
The source text makes a massive point about wildcards here, actually. It says never to use a wildcard like GetIt in that allowed tools list when you go to production.
Wildcards are a massive vulnerability.
Yeah.
Let's say you were using the GitHub MCP server to let the agent check on repository issues.
Okay.
You might be tempted to just grant McP GitIt up to save time.
Right. Just let it access anything GitHub related.
But that gives the agent the power to delete repositories, change user permissions, merge pull requests.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you definitely don't want that.
If it only needs to read issues, you grant exactly McP GitHub list issues. The goal is least privilege, giving the agent the exact capabilities it needs to function autonomously, and nothing more.
Okay, so we have the allowed tool set. We've locked down the static laws of the agent. But let's go back to that 40-minute looping scenario from earlier.
The runaway cost issue.
Right. If I give an agent permission to use the read tool, what stops it from legally using that tool 5,000 times in a row when it gets stuck?
That is the big question.
Because static permissions don't solve loops. The agent is technically following the rules, it's just doing it, well, excessively.
And this is exactly where static rules fall short and we have to introduce dynamic intervention.
Enter the hook system.
Precisely. The Claude Agent SDK provides this hook system. If you have ever worked with back-end web servers, you can think of hooks as being very much like HTTP middleware.
Like a lifecycle callback framework?
Yes. Developers can attach their own custom functions, written in Python or TypeScript, to specific events that trigger while the agent is running.
So we are putting programmable checkpoints along the agent's journey.
That's a great way to put it. The core architecture usually revolves around the two most critical checkpoints, pre-tool use and post-tool use.
Before the tool executes and after the tool executes. Here's where it gets really interesting, actually. I was thinking about how to handle budget caps, and using a post-tool use hook to enforce a budget cap is essentially like getting a credit card fraud alert text on your phone after your friend just bought a Ferrari on your account.
That is a brilliant analogy.
It's informative, sure, you know you're broke. But it is way too late. The money is gone. The file is already overwritten.
Exactly.
If you want to stop a disaster, you need a pre-tool use hook, which is the card getting declined at the dealership before the keys are even handed over.
I love that. It perfectly maps to the internal mechanics of the SDK. Let's break down the hands-on exercise from the coding materials to see how the code actually handles that declined transaction.
Let's do it.
Imagine you have configured a hard cap of 500,000 input tokens for a specific user session.
Okay, 500,000.
The agent has been running successfully, making various tool calls, but your tracking system shows you have just hit 505,000 tokens.
So you are officially over budget. The Ferrari is at the checkout counter.
Right. The agent, completely unaware of the external budget, decides it needs to call the edit tool to modify three more system files to finish its task.
But because we have that pre-tool use hook.
Exactly. Because you implemented a pre-tool use circuit breaker, the SDK intercepts the request. Before that first edit command can even touch the disk, your custom callback function runs.
It evaluates the current token count.
Yes, it sees that you are over the 500,000 cap, and it intercepts the action. It returns a specific payload to the SDK permission decision. Deny.
It slams the brakes. The files on the disk don't change. But wait, what happens to the agent? Does the whole application just crash and throw a fatal error?
That is the most elegant part of the design, actually. The model doesn't crash blindly. The underlying mechanism injects that denial reason directly back into Claude's context window as system feedback.
Oh, that's smart.
Yeah, the model receives a message essentially saying, you know, your tool call was denied because the budget cap was exceeded.
So the session is gracefully halted, the current state of the task is preserved, and the developer can inspect exactly what the agent was trying to do when it hit the limit.
Right, the agent actually learns why it was stopped.
Okay, so we've established our circuit breaker, which handles the cost side of things. But the Koenig text outlines a complete production hook stack-like, four specific hooks you need before any agent goes live.
Let's build the rest of that stack. We mentioned the post-tool use hook earlier, and while it's too late for prevention, it is the absolute perfect place for an autolog.
Okay. Every single time a tool modifies a file or accesses a system, this hook should write a permanent entry.
Exactly. So when the database goes down on Tuesday, we can trace it back to a specific bash command the agent ran on Monday night.
What exactly needs to go into that log to make it useful, though?
At a bare minimum, you need a precise timestamp, the exact style path or resource that was altered, and, crucially, the unique session ID.
Right, because without the session ID, you just have a massive list of disconnected actions.
Yeah, you'd have no way to group them into a single agent's train of thought.
Makes total sense. We have the pre-tool circuit breaker, the post-tool audit log. Hook number three is the user prompt submit hook.
This one fires the moment a user message is submitted to the system before it is even sent to the Claude model.
So like a prompt sanitization layer.
Exactly. If your application handles sensitive data, you need to strip out personally identifiable information, PII, like social security numbers or credit cards, before it ever touches the LLM context window.
Which is huge for compliance.
And you can also use this hook to scan for dangerous prompt injection patterns.
Which is absolutely non-negotiable for enterprise security. Finally, we have hook number four, session lifecycle telemetry.
Tracking when a session starts and when it ends.
But the text mentions a weird technical quirk here, depending on the language you're programming in, right?
Yeah, it's a bit of a gotcha. The hook framework runs across both Python and TypeScript, but the implementations are not perfectly mirrored yet. If you are building with a TypeScript SDK, you have native built-in support for session start and session end events. You simply attach a callback function to them.
Okay, that's easy enough.
But the official Python SDK callbacks currently do not support those lifecycle events natively.
Wait, really? If I'm a Python developer building a massive backend, how do I track my session links? Am I just out of luck?
No, but you do have to build your own workaround. The guide outlines two strategies for Python. You can manually emit your own session start event locally the moment you receive the very first API response back from the Claude SDK client.
Okay, that's one way.
Or you could define specific shell hooks inside a configuration file called .quadsettings.json and load them as project settings. It requires a bit more manual wiring, but it guarantees you capture that telemetry data.
Good to know. So we have four robust hooks running. We are auditing files, breaking circuits, scrubbing PII, and tracking the start and end of sessions. Yeah. Our agent is constantly making automated decisions and kicking out logs. But what do we actually do with this mountain of telemetry? Just watching a wall of text scroll by in a terminal isn't going to help anyone debug a production outage.
And this is where we shift from simply controlling the agent to truly observing it. The golden rule here is that raw print statements are useless in production.
So no print agent successfully edited file.
Exactly. If your logs look like plain text sentences, you cannot analyze them at scale. Every event your hooks generate needs to be a structured object, specifically structured JSON.
So every log entry has predefined keys and values. Why is JSON the magic format here?
Because external observability platforms, industry standard tools like LangFuse, Datadog, or AWS CloudWatch are built to ingest and index structured JSON.
Ah, I see.
When the data is consistently structured, these platforms can instantly parse it and allow you to run really complex queries.
So if we use structured logs, what kind of insights are we actually pulling out of, say, LangFuse or Datadog?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, structured logging shifts you from guessing to knowing. You can instantly query your possession cost breakdown.
Which solves our first problem.
Right. You can track the error rate by tool type. You might discover your GitHub server integration fails 10 times more often than your local file system tools.
That's incredibly valuable.
You can also calculate token efficiency, measuring how many input tokens it takes the agent to achieve one actually useful result.
It turns an unpredictable AI into a measurable, predictable software component. But, bringing up efficiency and optimization leads us to my absolute favorite part of the chapter.
The contrarian production advice.
Yes, because usually the second a developer deploys an application, their immediate instinct is to optimize. They want to aggressively cut down token usage, tune the model size, or build complex caching layers.
And the Koenig AI Academy explicitly tells developers, do not do that. Their fundamental advice is log before you optimize.
Which feels so counterintuitive to ignore optimization. Why wouldn't you want to minimize your API costs on day one?
Because on day one, you are operating entirely on blind assumptions.
Fair point.
Developers are notoriously bad at guessing how an autonomous agent will behave in the wild. You might spend two entire weeks building a brilliant, complex caching system for a database tool, only to look at the logs a month later and realize the agent only calls that tool 2% of the time.
That would be brutal.
The text argues that until you have structured logs for at least 100 real production sessions, you don't actually know anything.
You don't know what prompts are eating the most tokens. You don't know your actual P99 session cost, meaning the extreme high-end cost of your most expensive 1% of runs.
Exactly. That P99 cost might be wildly different from the optimistic estimate you scribbled on a whiteboard.
So let the data drive the engineering.
Yes. Deploy the agent with the strict safe hook stack we just built. Let it run in the real world for a couple of weeks. Gather that structured JSON data.
And then optimize your architecture based on hard evidence.
Right, because the guardrails give you the safety net to collect that data without risking bankruptcy.
Okay, so we have the hooks built, the logs structured, and the patience to wait before optimizing. We are ready to deploy. But where does an AI agent actually live in the cloud?
Well, the SDK runs anywhere Python or Node.js runs, but the sources break down three specific deployment targets.
And I imagine the choice of target depends entirely on how long your agent needs to think to complete its tasks.
You nailed it. The first option is serverless functions, like AWS Lambda or Google Cloud Functions.
I've used Lambda for standard web APIs, but why would we put an autonomous agent there? Don't serverless functions have strict time limits?
They do. Serverless functions are ephemeral, meaning they spin up, run, and die very quickly. They usually have a hard timeout cutoff of about 15 minutes.
So this target is strictly for short, bounded tasks.
Correct.
But because they are ephemeral, the file system disappears when the function dies. How does the agent save its memory?
You have to configure an environment variable called Cloud Sessions dir to point to a temporary folder, like temp. But remember, when the function call starts next time, that data is gone. You cannot resume a multi-turn conversation across different serverless invocations unless you build a separate database to store and retrieve the session history.
Okay, so Lambda is for quick one-off tasks. What if I have an agent that needs to analyze a massive code base for a few hours, requiring multiple turns and resuming sessions?
Then you graduate to the second target long-running containers, things like EC2 instances or Kubernetes pods.
Right.
This environment is perfect for multi-turn sessions because the agent's memory persists on the container's disk. But this introduces a dangerous new physical risk.
Which is?
Unbounded session file growth.
Oh, let's unpack that, because the agent is constantly writing logs.
Specifically, it writes a JSON file of JSON lines, where every single action and thought is appended as a new line. These files grow sequentially with every tool call.
I see where this is going.
Yeah, if you have 10 agents running for a week, those files just keep getting bigger until the server literally runs out of hard drive space and crashes.
Yikes.
If you deploy to a container, the text mandates that you implement a session retention policy. You must add a scheduled script inside that container to automatically delete JSON files older than 7 days.
Dealing with disk space and scheduled deletion scripts sounds like a massive headache for a small team, honestly.
Which is exactly why the third target exists, managed agents.
Okay.
These are hosted directly by Anthropic. Mm-hmm. You don't have to manage campaign directories. You don't have to write retention policies. It's designed for long-running asynchronous tasks where you just want to hand the infrastructure management over to the provider.
That sounds way easier. Before we wrap up, though, there is one crucial detail the text mentions about configurations, regardless of where you deploy. It's about handling API keys.
Yes. You should never, ever have hard-coded API keys in your configuration files.
Right.
If you are using admcp.json file to configure your servers, you must use the VRR syntax. This ensures the application pulls the secret dynamically from the secure environment variables at runtime. Never commit a raw token to version control.
So what does this all mean? We started this deep dive talking about the fear of an AI hallucinating or going rogue.
Yeah.
But when you look at this entire production playbook, the strict explicit permissions, the pre-tool circuit breakers, the structured audit logs, and the secure environments, it becomes clear that taking an agent to production isn't actually about perfectly trusting the AI.
Not at all.
It is about building a robust, observable system around the AI. A system that guarantees safety and budget, even when the probabilistic model inside of it acts completely unpredictably.
It's a fundamental paradigm shift in how we think about software architecture. And honestly, this raises an important question, something for you to ponder long after this deep dive is over.
Oh, I like where this is going.
Think about it. If we implement all these strict circuit breakers, these precise lifecycle hooks, and absolute permission boundaries, the agent is effectively operating inside a highly regulated digital terrarium.
A terrarium. Wow, yeah.
As we add more and more deterministic guardrails to prevent our probabilistic AI models from misbehaving, at what point does the autonomous agent cease to be autonomous?
That's a great point.
Does it just become a traditional software application that occasionally has to ask a language model for permission to proceed? How much autonomy is actually left in a production-safe agent?
That is a fascinating line to walk between autonomy and absolute control. A massive thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Before you deploy your next project, double check your permission settings. Make sure your Ferrari is protected before you hand over the keys. We'll see you next time.